Israeli military released new video showing the firefights and street battles underway with Hamas militants as soldiers encircle Gaza City. But civilians continue to bear the worst of the violence. Hamas health officials said an Israeli airstrike hit a convoy of ambulances outside the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza City. Israel has accused Hamas of using the grounds as a command center. But images show a number of civilians among the victims, adding to a death toll that continues to mount by the day.
As the conflict intensifies, the Pentagon has suspended travel by members of Congress and senior Defense Department officials to Israel.
The memo from Defense Secretary Austin restricts all but the most senior Pentagon officials from traveling to Israel and says military support for congressional travel requires his personal approval. Defense officials say Austin issued the memo in an effort to discourage what one called combat tourism, non-essential visits that require military aircraft at a time when the U.S. is already airlifting weapons and supplies into Israel and other countries throughout the Middle East. Members of Congress can still travel to Israel, but they'll have to get there on their own, not aboard military aircraft. David Martin, CBS News, The Pentagon.
Republican presidential contenders are attending the Florida Freedom Summit near Orlando later today.
The Ron DeSantis-Donald Trump battle is expected to be the headliner. Florida governor running far behind the former president in most of the polls. Trump's purpose here is
to give DeSantis maximum embarrassment in his home state.
University of Central Florida professor Jim Clark says this could be the beginning of the end.
Governor DeSantis thought this was going to be his big moment in the sun, and they have made him a warm-up act.
The low-profile afternoon speaking slot. Frontrunner Trump is in prime time. Peter King, CBS News, Orlando.
A carry-on bag on a JetBlue plane exploded this week just before taking off from New York's JFK Airport. CBS's Margaret Brennan.
Video posted on social media shows flight attendants pouring water on the backpack. Officials say the lithium-ion battery for a portable phone charger was to blame, and the bag owner suffered minor burns.
This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. This is Civic Media. This is Civic Media.
It's the final home game of the season for Carroll University football this Saturday, November 4th. The Pioneers will also celebrate Senior Day as the Big Blue of Millikan University visits the Schneid. You can catch all of the action.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Federal initiatives are spurring a range of new infrastructure projects in rural America. As Mike Moan reports, President Biden was in Minnesota this week to talk about water system improvements and broadband access.
Biden visited a farm near Northfield to discuss funding from recent packages such as the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act, with the latter focusing on climate projects and healthcare assistance. For agriculture, the administration says there's new funding for farmers to take advantage of climate-friendly practices such as nutrient management, with other provisions designed to create market fairness. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says these efforts allow rural residents to try and keep their communities vibrant.
They want their families to have the opportunity to farm and to work and to raise their families in the small communities where they come from.
And while the infrastructure law receives support from lawmakers on both sides, Republicans strongly oppose the Inflation Reduction Act. They've been trying to cut some elements of the law amid budget battles in Congress. Meanwhile, there's $65 billion within the infrastructure law to boost access to high-speed internet. Josh Sumption is with an education service agency for the southwest and west central parts of the state.
For schools, it's really about students being able to continue to learn and take their homework home and stay connected to their educational institutions and the resources that they're using in the classroom.
He says the pandemic made worse some of the internet connection challenges rural students face. Sumption acknowledges recent federal investments might not close all broadband gaps, but he says he's hopeful that more projects will be shovel-ready very soon, citing additional funding from the state. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. Your hometown radio refreshed. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Mainly cloudy this afternoon with a high of 51. Winds out of the north, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Lows around 33. Tonight, partly cloudy skies. Cloudy skies tomorrow, 54. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 37 degrees.
Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, November 4th, 2023. This is the 70th broadcast of Morning Cannolis. Thank you so much for joining me and my wonderful producer, Anya, here this morning. Broadcast stations throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. We are talking, as always. This is our review, our analysis, our consideration, our discussion of the most important issues in the areas of law and of government and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you with us this morning as we talk through a number of significant events, significant news stories of just this past week that focus upon justice in America, its delivery imperfect and sometimes incomplete, but nonetheless a system that attempts as best as possible to address not only criminal conduct, but the larger purpose, as we discussed in our first hour, the larger purpose to ensure the safety and security of all of us, that humanity is enhanced, and the basic norms that we embrace as Americans, as citizens of this planet, are observed by all of us to the good of all of us. And spend some time in the first minutes of this hour talking about some cases involving the former president, Donald Trump. And we'll begin with that criminal case that I made reference to at the end of our first hour, pending in the D.C. court, the district court there in front of Tanya Chutkan. This is the indictment brought by the special counsel of the U.S. Department of Justice named Jack Smith. It alleges against one defendant, but four different counts, violations of federal law, including conspiracy to affect civil rights in connection with the January 4th events. We know that Judge Chutkan did a number of things this past week, including very late in this past week, with respect to the trial that's coming up for trial in the spring. She's set that already on her calendar. And indeed, she's apparently serious about it because she's begun to tell the attorneys on both sides, the prosecutors and also the defense attorneys, that they should begin to put together materials, as we always do in criminal cases, in anticipation of what? Of jury selection. She's already thinking about the mechanisms for calling jurors in, and she wants to be involved with not only that process as she plainly supervises it, but also wants the attorneys themselves to be a part of that process to ensure that it has integrity. And again, the question in connection with the identification of jurors, one may often wonder, well, gee, where are you going to find jurors that know nothing about the case, who know nothing about the former president, who know nothing about his presence in the national landscape these days? And that's not the question. The question posed of prospective jurors that she is now soliciting, that is the judge now soliciting from the attorneys for the prosecution, the defense, has to do with identifying those potential juror members of the jury, who may know something about this case, but can still come into the court and decide the criminal case based upon the things that they see in the four corners of the courtroom itself. It doesn't mean that you purge your mind of what you know, but you've got the analytical capacity, the intellectual capacity to look at the evidence impartially, anew, and determine whether or not the government has met its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, now at the trial level, that the defendant, the former president, did in fact commit the four different felonies charged in the indictment. She's already talking with them about how we select members of that jury coming up in the spring of this year. That's one significant thing that happened just this past week. The other significant thing, getting even more news attention, also a part of the rule of law, regular process in America, comes back to the issue that we have discussed at great length. Tanya Chutkan, at the encouragement of the prosecution, Jack Smith, the special counsel, has asked her to impose, again, what's being described as a gag order, not my favorite phrase, because it conveys the sense that somehow a defendant is being gagged or that their First Amendment rights are being affected detrimentally, inappropriately, by virtue of gagging a person who is in court. That is not the case. And so I much prefer to refer to all of these orders that are being entered right now by judges, both the federal system and also the state system, as orders that require compliance with the fundamental trappings of criminal prosecution, including the way that we focus upon future jury members, witnesses, and even court staff. And so at the encouragement of the prosecution, the judge in this case, Tanya Chutkan, did in fact issue an order directing that the defendant not talk about witnesses, not talk about future potential jury members, not talk about other members of the prosecution. Interestingly, she left herself off the list, but she basically said, you cannot affect the conduct of the trial that I'm going to be conducting in a number of months from now. And almost immediately, Donald Trump, as you know well from the news, has been out there conducting himself both on social media and in public settings in a way that's plainly contrary to what the judge has directed. He has called the prosecutor deranged, made other scurrilous comments about witnesses who are coming up. And all this prompts the special counsel to come back to the judge and say, Judge, this needs to be done. And she indeed reimposes the restrictions that she talked about initially. At the time of that initial order that she issued, she decided to stay or kind of suspend it while the appeals court reviewed whether or not it was legitimate. The counsel for Donald Trump had taken this up to the D.C. Court of Appeals, that is the appellate court that reviews decisions by lower courts, and she was going to let that play out. But the government comes back again this past week and says there's more of this. He is continuing to do this kind of thing, and so that prompts Judge Tanya Chutkan to reimpose her order, directing that Donald Trump not engage in this kind of behavior. And that prompts the attorneys for Donald Trump to seek an immediate review, which they did in just the past couple of days or so, before the D.C. Court of Appeals, asking that the D.C. court, the higher court, tell the lower court not to go ahead with its order. It is a stunning move. It's not surprising. It's a stunning move because it misunderstands the basic trappings of the First Amendment. As I said, nothing about what the judge is doing here doesn't apply in every other federal and state criminal case that's out there. We do not permit defendants who are running for the presidency or not to engage in this kind of behavior that affects the jury pool, that has the impact of intimidating witnesses, perhaps, that even suggests that the people who are involved in the courtroom, the prosecutors, court staff, are involved in undermining the trappings of justice, all of that. We do not permit that in any circumstance. And indeed, Judge Chutkan has said that. She said, I'm not going to permit this defendant to behave in a way that's different from every other defendant who appears in front of me. We will see what happens in this case. Unlikely that the Court of Appeals is going to rescind or vacate the order entered by Judge Chutkan. But that's where it stands right now. And along the way, underscoring the importance of this particular dust-up, if you will, more than that, but certainly a dust-up in terms of its relative comparison to the other things in this very important case, a federal case going to the January 6th events. We also know that the ACLU, just this past week, attempted to file an amicus brief, which is a brief, amicus ami, meaning friend of the court. And the ACLU was arguing that the judge's limited order, again, which I've described already, forbidding Donald Trump from publicly attacking special counsel and others involved in this process, The ACLU arguing that that order by the judge was too broad and that does in fact implicate and restrict Donald Trump's First Amendment rights. The petition, the amicus brief that is being presented by the ACLU says this: no modern day president did more damage to civil liberties and civil rights than President Trump. But if we allow his free speech rights to be abridged, we know that other unpopular voices, even ones we agree with, will also be silenced. That's the executive director of the ACLU. And with due respect, I disagree with him, which is what we can do in this country. That is not a violation of your First Amendment. Your First Amendment, like all the other amendments in the Constitution, is not inviolate. It's not unconditional. And yes, indeed, for the purposes of justice, some limited restrictions on your capacity to speak, attacking witnesses, potentially having impact upon future members of the jury pool, that is not an exercise of your First Amendment right that cannot be restricted. That's what the judge is doing. With due respect to the ACLU, their petition, from my perspective, not properly focused. And indeed, the judge says in the end that she is not going to consider it. She says, although courts have in rare instances exercised their discretion to permit third-party submissions in criminal cases, neither the federal rules of criminal procedure nor the local criminal rules, those are the local rules established by the district court there, neither sets of those contemplate the filing of amicus curiae briefs. The judge goes on to say, at this time, the court does not find it necessary to depart from the ordinary procedural clause by permitting this filing. So although it's there, she rejects it in terms of her own review of this. She has got sufficient basis upon which to do that procedural thing, that decision that she is making. And again, the focus of this, an important issue for discussion, reasonable people can disagree about how far the First Amendment goes. From my perspective, in this case, Donald Trump, as the judge herself and others have said, can advocate in the public domain, can say things about his own belief that he is innocent. We know that that attends him, that presumption of innocence. He can talk about his sense that the prosecution, the bringing of the case itself, the indictment itself is unfounded. But what you can't do, and the line that he has crossed now, which has this impact upon what goes on in court, is to attack individuals who are involved in the delivery of justice. And those people are witnesses, they're jurors, and yes, indeed, they are people who are involved not only in prosecution, but other court staff as well. That issue coming up also in the state case pending in New York. And we know as well that that case also going on just this past week, lots of activity there. We know that the court in New York State there, that case involving testimony from members of the Trump organization. And while that is going on, while that is happening, a lot of coverage of that particular case as well, which we're going to get to in just a moment or so. I mentioned before that the ACLU is also petitioning right now the United States Supreme Court to take a case, to grant certiorari, which is again the Latin, the legal phrase for agreeing to accept a case that is pending out there in the lower courts. ACLU wants the Supreme Court in another matter, unrelated to these matters pending in federal court right now in New York. The American Civil Liberties asking the Supreme Court to block a Tennessee law that bans gender-affirming care for minors. Just on Wednesday of this past week, along with the ACLU of Tennessee and some other entities, the ACLU petitioned the court to review a Sixth Circuit case coming out of the appellate court, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, that allows the state's anti-trans law to go into effect. The appeals court is basically saying, yes, that anti-trans law can go into effect, and the...
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
The Shaw, WAUK.
We are back here in Morning Cannolis talking now about more administration of justice, this time in a New York court, a civil court in Manhattan, being presided over by Judge Arthur Engoron. Cases have been going on for a number of different weeks here. Lots of testimony, presumably in support of the allegations made by the state attorney general that the Trump Organization and individuals, including Donald Trump, including his sons, Donald Trump Jr., including Eric Trump, all of them and other individuals inside the Trump Organization, illegally, unlawfully valued certain properties at various rates, depending upon who the petitions, the documents were presented to. Insurance companies, banks seeking loans, many of these things presided over by Judge Engoron this past week and in previous weeks, in that state prosecution alleging violations of state law for inappropriately valuing and reporting, committing to paper things that were not true about the size of properties, the value of properties, and changing those depending upon the recipient of them. This past week, as you probably know, some major testimony from members of the Trump family. They are themselves defendants in this case, called interestingly, by the state itself, by the attorney general and the attorneys prosecuting this case in the state court there. Donald Trump Jr. called as a part of the prosecution case, presumably to talk more about what's happening inside the Trump Organization, and in particular, the focus of this case on what he knew about what was going on inside this organization. During the course of the testimony, both Donald Trump Jr. and later Eric Trump this past week testified focusing on two major areas. One is that in their roles as executives of the Trump Organization, they were not involved in this kind of activity. They were not involved in the weeds, if you will, when it comes to the kinds of things that are alleged in the civil charges brought by the Attorney General. For example, Donald Trump Jr. testified that when the question was whether he worked on a statement in which there were misstatements about the value of a certain type of property. And he said, I did not work on it. The accountants worked on it. That's what we pay them for. Again, a huge amount of direction in the courtroom this past week from the Trump sons, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, indicating that they themselves were not responsible. They may have signed off on these documents, but that was the accountants. That was the lawyers. It was other people. We pay them to do that. I did not focus on that, and therefore I did not have the intent, if you will, even the civil intent in this case, to engage the kind of violations that the Attorney General is alleging in this case. Similarly, Eric Trump, also on the stand this past week, likewise talking about the fact that from his perspective, that these things were not in his ambit. He said, I do not get myself involved in these kinds of things. He was repeating in many ways what he said in a deposition, a civil deposition, prior to the trial. And during the course of that, he said, I pour concrete. I operate properties. I don't focus on appraisals. In other words, that's not my bailiwick, not the things I focus on. Therefore, his argument is implicitly, if not explicitly, that he should not be held responsible for engaging in this kind of conduct. Well, that only gets you so far. It plainly describes in greater detail the people who might be involved in this kind of activity, but it only gets you so far when it comes to responsibility, especially in a closely held organization like the Trump Organization, already of that kind of testimony presented in court about the fact that this is closely held and that Donald Trump himself was involved in many of these specific transactions. Many things, if not all things, passed in front of him. The same with the sons. Donald Trump Jr., and Eric Trump as well. We spoke last week on last week's broadcast about the testimony of Michael Cohen, the former lawyer, the former fixer, and he put together the cement on all this as well, that the Trump boys, the sons, and the father himself always involved in these kinds of transactions. Nothing happens, Michael Cohen testified, absent some involvement of these particular players, suggesting that what Eric and Donald Trump Jr. said this past week, inconsistent with what the former fixer, the former lawyer, Michael Cohen, remembers, recalls well from his time inside the Trump organization. Again, why is all of this important? Well, a couple of things to take away. One is, it is significant that in a civil trial, we have statements made by individuals about matters, transactions that, again, are civil in nature. These are not criminal. But depending upon how one looks at them, and depending upon the kinds of things, not only the evidence presented in court, but other investigative matters, could in fact result in criminal prosecutions, in criminal charges that could also be brought, depending upon the nature of the fraud that's identified, where it was done, the kind of thing that was done, could lead to criminal prosecutions as well. Interestingly, of course, this past week, Eric Trump, Donald Trump, did not invoke their rights in the Fifth Amendment to be free from self-incrimination. There is a clear right in the Constitution not to implicate yourself and provide testimony that would tend to suggest that you're involved in crime itself. They did not invoke the Fifth Amendment during the course of their testimony in court. They did so hundreds of times in the depositions that led up to the trial, but they didn't do so during the course of the proceedings themselves, probably in part because they're thinking about what the implications of that would be. We know as well from this and many other cases that you can indeed invoke the Fifth Amendment in a civil case. It doesn't have to just be a criminal matter. A civil case can support the invocation of the Fifth Amendment. But we also know that if you do that, an adverse inference, that is a decision, a judgment call made by the trier of fact, in this case the judge, could be pursued, could be put in place, an adverse inference that your decision not to testify about this particular thing protected by the Constitution nonetheless supports the conclusion that your decision, your response, had you made it, would have tended to suggest that you're in violation of the law. Maybe the civil law, maybe the criminal law, certainly the criminal law, if you're invoking the Fifth Amendment. That adverse inference can in fact be made, and that can be used in the civil case with respect to the judgment. Judge Engerand here already having found that there has been a fraud in this case, and the trial that's now going on, focusing on damages, focusing on intent, what people did inside the organization, that's what this is all about. We also know this coming week, other things to look at. Donald Trump himself is scheduled to testify on Monday. And then, late this past week, the judge also rejected the continuing petition from Ivanka Trump, the daughter of Donald Trump, the sister of Donald Jr. and Eric, rejected her continuing request that she not be required to come forward. The judge said, nope, you got to come forward. And she is also scheduled to testify in this trial, this civil trial, pending in the state court in New York. And it will continue next week with this major testimony from the former president and his daughter as a part of that trial. Stay with us for our discussion as we continue to talk about these and other issues in here, our broadcast on Morning Cannolis.
Your home. home for the Devil's Advocates. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Jordan meeting with the head of the United Nations agency helping Palestinian refugees.
It's important to be here at UNRWA, which is doing extraordinary work every single day as a lifeline to Palestinians in Gaza, and at great cost.
This as civilians in Gaza continue suffering as Israel continues hammering the area. CBS's Deborah Pata is there.
Just this morning, several more strikes in Gaza hitting a hospital entrance, a water tank supplying communities in the south, and a school used to house thousands of people whose homes have been flattened.
If you have a little extra time to party overnight, that's thanks to daylight saving time, which goes into effect at 2 a.m. Eastern in most states. CBS's Stacey Lynn explains.
48 states and the District of Columbia will turn back their clocks. It will be lighter out when you get up in the morning, but will get dreary and dark earlier in the evening.
CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. It's your hometown radio. Refreshed.
It's the Badgers at Indiana. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin Badgers face off against the Indiana Hoosiers at Memorial Stadium in Bloomington. Indiana made a change last month, hiring Rod Carey as their new offensive coordinator. The 52-year-old was born and raised in Madison, Wisconsin. How's their offense improved? Badgers head coach Luke Fickell.
You know, I think this is a team that's creating and generating some momentum. I think they're playing better. You know, I think they're into a rhythm a little bit more offensively than maybe they were in the first five games as they made the switch. But it's going to be about special teams. It's going to be about making sure we can eliminate big plays and creating them some way, somehow for us offensively.
NFL, the Packers host the Rams on Sunday. On defense, safety Rudy Ford is questionable after missing practice with a calf injury. Running back Aaron Jones wore a red no-contact jersey all week in practice, just like the quarterbacks, as he comes back from that lingering hamstring injury. Matt LaFleur.
He did a great job. We did that for his own protection.
With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Mainly cloudy this afternoon with a high of 51. Winds out of the north, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Low is around 33. Tonight, partly cloudy skies. Cloudy skies tomorrow, 54. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 39 degrees.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Why choose Weichert Realtors? Because your community is our community. We're your neighbors, your students, your chefs, your soldiers, your builders, your actors, your musicians, and your radio personalities. We love this city as much as you do, and that's why we want to help you live your best life here. Because we are your realtors. Call us today and let us help you find your next home. 608-821-7002 or visit Weichert-LakePoint.com. Weichert Realtors Lake Point, a home for all.
Tis the season for Village Hearth Dinner Rolls. Not only are a warm basket of fresh brown and serve or sweet Hawaiian pull-apart rolls the perfect accompaniment to holiday meals, they make great little sandwiches for a quick and easy lunch or dinner. Visit VillageHearthBreads.com for slider recipes, including chicken buffalo, pizza, and currywurst. Village Hearth Breads, baking our best for you.
Be a part of the resistance. Check out The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson, Monday nights at 7 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK, and on the Civic Media app.
You are never far away from your favorite local radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app, and we invite you to get social with us by following our network's Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook pages. Want even more? CivicMedia.us.
Keeping Southeast Wisconsin informed, engaged, and entertained. This is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
that you hide behind that mask you use. And did you think this fool could never win? Well, look at me, I'm coming back again. I got a taste of love in a simple way. And if you need to know while I'm still standing, you just fade away. Don't you know?
Welcome back to this, our broadcast on Saturday, November 4th, 2023. This is Morning Cannolis, joined by my wonderful producer, Anya. As we talk now more about the Constitution. We began this discussion a bit at the end of our last broadcast, and we were focusing at that time on a discussion revolving around the 14th Amendment. A lot of discussion out there about a provision of the 14th Amendment, the third section of the 14th Amendment, rarely, if ever, invoked, but invoked routinely now, in determining whether or not the former president, Donald Trump, if his name should appear on ballots in states around the nation. What does the 14th Amendment say? Well, in Section 1, we always know, we recall the language there that provides that all persons born or naturalized in the United States of America are citizens of the United States. This is basically a post-Civil War amendment ratified by the courts, by the states, and enforced by the courts in 1868. Prohibiting making any laws that abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the state, forbidding states to deprive people of life, liberty, or property without due process, denying people within the jurisdiction of the United States the equal protection of laws. That's how we normally think of the 14th Amendment. That's in Section 1 of the amendment itself. But Section 3 says this: no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress, or elector of president or vice president, or hold any office, and this is the important language, hold any office, civil or military, under the United States, or under any state, who having previously taken an oath of office, raised your right hand and took the oath of office to be allegiant to the Constitution, to support the legitimate operations and the trappings of government, or as a member of the state legislature and officer of any state, to support the Constitution, to do those things one is supposed to do in an official capacity, any person who has previously engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, is prohibited from serving in any of those capacities, including any office, civil or military, under the United States or any state. And that would presumably, certainly does include the presidency of the United States of America. And so using that language pulled up from the third section of the 14th Amendment, we have got around the country a number of pieces of civil litigation, not criminal, but civil litigation meant to enforce that provision of the 14th Amendment. And a lot of debate out there about how one goes about effectuating that language. There are an awful lot of people who believe that only the Congress is the entity, the body, that can make a finding of insurrection such that a particular person would be prohibited from serving in any of those capacities. There are others, and plainly that's the focus of at least two major cases underway just this past week in Colorado and again in Minnesota. Others out there would say, no, the courts can make that finding as well. The courts can make a determination premised upon evidence presented before them about whether or not a particular defendant has violated the basic trappings of our society, of our nation, engaged in insurrection of the kind that is described in Section 3, and therefore cannot hold office. We know that some of those previous efforts to go into the courts to prevent some candidates, typically Republicans in our nation, Republicans running for the Congress, some of those have failed. However, there was a case in New Mexico. We talked about it on this broadcast many, many weeks and months ago, where a local commissioner who was previously convicted of trespassing of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, was basically booted from his office. And how did that happen? Turns out that there is a state court judge out there who said, no, this person cannot be engaged in the operation of that particular job there in New Mexico. Why? Because he was previously convicted in federal court, in the District of Columbia District Court, for engaging in the insurrectionist activity of January 6th. And that, according to the judge in that case, is sufficient to establish that that particular person, this particular local commissioner, convicted of trespassing, that is sufficient to support a finding of engaging insurrection such that the oath of office could not be taken, could not be properly pursued by that commissioner, such that he had to be removed from office. We know that that happened. So there's a bit of precedent out there. It is limited, and it is arguably small in nature, but there are other attempts consistent with that, again, going on right now in Colorado and in Minnesota. Efforts to keep former President Trump off the ballot under the 14th Amendment actually were before the Minnesota Supreme Court just on Thursday of this past week, and several of the justices there during oral arguments appeared somewhat wary that they should be the ones to determine the eligibility, wondering again out loud whether this is a judicial matter, a congressional matter. Who is the one who decides this sort of thing? The litigation itself, again, focusing on this provision in the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, five Minnesota Supreme Court justices, four of whom were appointed by Democrats, are weighing this case after two others on the court recused themselves because of concerns about some various threshold issues. One of the justices said this to Donald Trump's attorney in this case. He said, "I think your argument about the political question doctrine is, I think that's a very serious problem for the other side of this case." Another justice on the Minnesota Supreme Court, her name is Natalie Hudson, suggested this is a national matter for Congress to decide, and that even if the court does have the authority, she would still hesitate. She said aloud, "Should we do it? Even if we do it, can we do it?" And again, much of the discussion during the course of the oral argument before the Supreme Court in Minnesota, tracking that very question about who is responsible, because there isn't a lot of precedent out there about the enforcement of this language. Minnesota's case, again, appearing in front of the Minnesota Supreme Court, very similar to other 14th Amendment cases around the country. I mentioned already that this trial is underway just this past week in Colorado on Donald Trump's eligibility there to appear on the ballot in Colorado. A lot of litigation. There are a lot of presentation there of witnesses during the course of that trial lasting all this week. All of that, again, focusing on whether or not Donald Trump engaged in insurrection. How is that defined? What kinds of things can one present in court to determine whether or not that particular section of the 14th Amendment should be applied here? Lots of discussion, lots of testimony by former members of the Trump Organization in that Colorado case just this past week, including some of his closest advisors, about what happened on January 6th, the things that they did, the things that they knew that the former president did on that day, all of this in an attempt to determine whether or not that was truly insurrection or something else. Interestingly, of course, in the federal indictment against Donald Trump, the word insurrection, the actual charge of insurrection, is not a part of that. Other cases, other instances of violations of the federal law charged in that four-count indictment, but insurrection itself not charged there. And so lots of variations on this. And again, it is a fascinating intellectual issue. It is certainly one that's going to have an impact upon not only, arguably, the particular ballots in Colorado, Minnesota, there are many other states where these pieces of litigation are also pending, but will also plainly have an impact upon our precedent when it comes to the 14th Amendment. This has not been tested widely in the United States of America. Now we're in the courts, and we've got justices and judges determining what the 14th Amendment means. They're doing this, of course, just months before we go into the major campaign efforts of the 2024 election, very mindful of the fact that as we gather on November 4th, a year from tomorrow, November 5th of 2024, is Election Day. And a year from tomorrow is the day in which we will elect the next president of the United States of America. Lots of things have got to happen between now and then, including, of course, the major primaries in virtually all the states of the Union. Lots of focus on that. Major conventions of both of the major parties. One of those happening in Chicago, one of those happening in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, both of them playing in the Midwest. Many, many things are going to happen, including, of course, these prosecutions, these civil prosecutions having to do with whether or not the ballot itself in various states should include the name of Donald Trump, or if not, was he engaged in insurrection such that his name should be prohibited from appearing on that state ballot? Lots and lots of issues there to discuss. And again, on this broadcast and others, we will continue to focus on those kinds of issues going forward. We have talked at great length in the past about the United States Supreme Court, and every single broadcast in recent weeks, we've turned in part to what's going on at our United States Supreme Court, because as we know, in ways that have existed for well over 200 years, but certainly in recent years, the United States Supreme Court, courts of our land generally, federal courts, state courts, have a dramatic impact upon who we are as a nation, who we are as our people. We talked at the top of our first hour about these cases pending, criminal cases pending in federal court, everything from securities fraud to officer violations of civil rights to anti-Semitic postings, all kinds of things out there, the storming Capitol, all those things happening in federal courts, also the state courts, as we've also just described. Supreme Court is no exception to all of that. The United States Supreme Court entertaining now 40 different cases just this past week, added some additional cases to its docket. It's up to 40 right now. Typically, the Supreme Court will take on about 60 cases altogether. And indeed, they're right up to 40 right now. Virtually every single circuit in the country has cases pending in front of the Supreme Court, situations where the court has said, yes, we're going to review those cases. And we've talked about some of those up to this point. The only circuit in the United States of America where there is not a case from the particular circuit is ours, the Seventh Circuit, which is Wisconsin and Illinois and Indiana. That may change. That may well change in the next few weeks and months. But right now, 40 cases pending. And as you know from our previous discussions and from your own monitoring of these cases, the Supreme Court entertaining oral argument on a regular basis. At the top of our discussion today, we're going to remind you of a major oral argument coming up next week. November 7th is a major case in Rahimi. We talked about this at great length, especially in the wake of the most recent shooting in Lewiston, Maine. Rahimi is this case in which the criminal defendant in federal court prosecuted and convicted for possessing using a weapon, while he also has against him a domestic violence restraining order imposed by a state court. The question is whether or not that domestic violence restraining order prohibits him from owning, using, operating a weapon, selling it, transferring. And a federal law passed by the United States Congress establishes just that, that if you indeed there is a state court judge who imposes upon you a restriction that you cannot engage in a contact with, communications with a particular person, because you've engaged in domestic violence before, the federal law prohibits you from owning and using and carrying a weapon. That's exactly what happened to Mr. Rahimi in a fairly graphic and horrendous series of facts with respect to his now former partner, convicted, and he challenges the underlying law, alleging that under the Second Amendment, he should be entitled to carry a weapon, to use a weapon, even though the state has found that he is subject to this restraining order. The question to be argued in front of the Supreme Court next week, whether or not that prohibition of federal law is in fact constitutional under the Second Amendment. Very interesting to listen to that oral argument. When we come back, I'm going to tell you about other oral arguments coming up in the coming week, and then reviewing a few of those from just this past week. Stay with us for that discussion.
Is the Shaw WAUK. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
The delusions of grandeur have come to an end, as has the campaign of former Vice President Mike Pence. you know, people didn't care for him so much. I don't know why. You know, January 6th, they just wanted to hang him at the gallows, Dom.
I mean, at least they knew his name. You know, there's no such thing as bad PR, Crudy.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Matt Flynn Direct.
When it comes to shutting down the government, what I'm afraid is Mike Johnson comes in, he'll say real smooth, I don't want to shut down the government. Here's a budget. And you'll go, hey, wait a minute. That has cuts in child care, Social Security. And he'll smile. He's sort of like Scott Walker. People who are unnervingly polite behind that kind of facade, they have a lot of inner weasels. They have too many inner weasels, quite frankly.
Matt Flynn Direct. Weekdays from 2 until 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live.
We are back here talking all about the United States Supreme Court, what happened this past week, and what's going to happen next week. In addition to the Rahimi case being argued before the United States Supreme Court, two other cases, not nearly as much in the public domain, not nearly as much focused on them by the national media. One of them called Department of Agriculture, Rural Development, Rural Housing Service versus Kurtz. It has to do with, again, important cases, important situations when it comes to the Fair Credit Reporting Act and whether it waives sovereign immunity of the United States of America, things that lawyers love to talk about, but having to do with an important application of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that case coming up on Monday for oral argument before the United States Supreme Court. And then a second case called Rudisill versus McDonough coming up for review on Wednesday of the coming week. Rudisill versus McDonough, that case involving veterans benefits, and in particular, with a veteran who has served two separate and distinct periods of qualifying service under various pieces of federal legislation can get benefits under both or one. How does that play out? Has to do with veterans benefits, Rudisill versus McDonough, that argument coming up on Wednesday. And again, those two cases in Rudisill and in Kurtz are on either side of the all-important case Rahimi, that going to be argued on the 7th of next week. We know as well that just this past week, the Supreme Court reviewed some other cases that we talked about in the past. We know that on Monday, they reviewed a major asset forfeiture case, a lot of it focusing on the process and the procedure by which forfeitures of properties go forward in our country. Interestingly, we had some allies on the court when it comes to the common views that they had. Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch expressing some concerns about the manner in which we pursue and accomplish asset forfeiture in this country. The case itself that was in front of the Supreme Court just this past week, Culley versus Marshall, presented this issue about whether or not someone who is a so-called innocent owner of a car should in fact be able to petition for the return of their property based upon their innocent owner claim if their car was somehow involved in some other illegal activity. Lots of discussion about whether or not the process there is proper under current federal law and current procedure, and also about what we should do generally when it comes to people like the two petitioners here. Both of them, Culley and Sutton, the two principal petitioners here, had lent their cars to friends to run errands. And during the course of those errands, the friends got involved in criminal conduct, not at all involving the petitioners here. Questions about whether or not under those circumstances, the innocent owners of those properties should get them back or whether their properties should be subject to forfeiture. Lots of discussion. Not clarity necessarily, but interesting that two justices on presumably opposite sides of the aisle generally, ideologically on the bench, Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch, believing that there are some serious issues to discuss here about the way in which we do forfeiture in America. At the end of the day, the court also looked this past week at this case involving Trump Too Small and the trademark that a lawyer coming out of California wanted to pursue. The Supreme Court this past week, skeptical of allowing that trademark to go ahead, likely going to affirm the decision of the Trademark Commission not to permit this particular phrase to be trademarked. Perhaps one of the sillier cases before the Supreme Court, again, argued just this past week. But in the middle of those, another very important case focusing upon the Supreme Court's great attention this term and presumably in future terms to social media. We know that last term, in connection with some major cases, the Supreme Court determined that social media providers like Twitter and Google and others out there cannot be held liable, cannot be held civilly liable for dangers, for harms caused when individuals who are using their platform post incendiary things, wrong information, particularly information about ISIS and ISIL that prompts violent behavior. Supreme Court last year determined that the social media providers are not liable for the things that people may post, including posts that are incendiary, that convey information that is plainly not only offensive, but also indoctrinating in such a way that individuals ultimately are injured, even killed in that case. Well, this coming term, this present term, and in the coming cases, the Supreme Court looking at a whole series of cases having to do with social media, the interaction between individuals and government when it comes to social media. In particular, this past week, the Supreme Court expressed some great concern during oral arguments about whether their rulings in a pair of social media cases could have broad repercussions beyond just the specific cases presented to them. This particular case, a couple of cases, involved elected officials who chose to post things on their personal websites, on their personal social media platforms that related to things in their official capacities, things about their operation, things about job opportunities, things that happened. The two cases brought against two California school board members and a Michigan city manager focusing on whether the government officials actually violated the First Amendment free speech rights of citizens when they blocked on their own social media accounts the access of other individuals to their accounts, when those social media platforms, again, provide information about the nature of the official work that they do. All of that, again, before the Supreme Court just this past week. The Supreme Court has also granted cert in a number of other cases having to do with whether or not state legislatures can impose restrictions limiting the capacity of social media providers to find that hate speech and other information posted online not accurate, whether they can bring that down, they can block, can prohibit the posting of those kinds of things online. That case also in front of the United States Supreme Court, along with others, a huge focus this term on social media and the intersection between the First Amendment and your rights as American citizens here in the United States of America. I'm going to talk more about those cases and many others next time when we get together next Saturday here on Morning Cannolis. Continue to join us. That'll be our 71st broadcast here on the Civic Media stations, the broadcast stations throughout our great state of Wisconsin. Have a great week, everybody.
Your home of the Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
It's the final home game of the season for Carroll University football this Saturday, November 4th. The Pioneers will also celebrate Senior Day as the Big Blue of Millikan University visits the Schneid. You can catch all of the action live with Don and Johnny, pregame at 12:30, kickoff at 1. Carroll versus Millikan for the final home game this Saturday on The Shaw,
WAUK 540 AM, 101.1 FM, and the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Allison Keyes. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is refusing calls for a humanitarian pause in its war with Hamas. This is Israeli airstrikes in Gaza hit overnight, including in places where Israel told civilians to take cover.